ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
One of the most fascinating questions we can ask as humans is what our world looked like before man arrived on the scene. With a lifespan dating back more than 4 billion years, finding answers to those questions about our Earth are not easy. That's why science plays such a critical role in helping humans understand what came before us. On this edition of UWM Today, we head to the end of the Earth, the Antarctica, for a story not so much about snow and ice, but about the forests that once grew in a part of the world that now is one of the most hostile environments we know. Our guest is Eric Gulbranson, an assistant professor of geosciences at UWM, who helped find evidence that trees once grew where glaciers now dominate. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Eric.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
It does seem kind of counterintuitive for most of us to imagine that in this very, very cold and mainly dark part of the world for 6 months, that there used to be forests.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably one of the most surprising finds about this type of research. Actually, the discovery of fossils dates back to like 1910, 1912. And so we've known about that surprising history of Antarctica for over a century now, that it had once hosted forests. And now in the intervening decades, with my work and the work of many other people, we've discovered a fossil record that goes back 400 million years on Antarctica.
Good Lord.
For forests.
And it, obviously the temperatures were different, the world climate was different back
absolutely.
Then.
Yep, absolutely. And it captures a wide range of different kind of temperature history. So the time interval I study dates back around 250, 280 million years. And we think the Antarctica is much more humid, much more warm than it is today, even though from our best estimates, Antarctica was around the South Pole even that far back in time. It's moved around somewhat in the intervening years.
Because the continents have drifted.
Exactly.
With all of the moves and tectonic plates in the Earth.
That's exactly right. But there's a funny quirk in for Antarctic history is that it kind of hovers around the South Pole even amidst all those like arranging tectonic plates. And so one of the neat things about the fossils that we find is that they're kind of a representation of an extinct ecosystem, a polar ecosystem, which we don't have today.
Well, let's paint a picture of what we think that this forest might have looked like
Absolutely.
At the South Pole.
And it's changed over time. Like initially, when we first found these plant fossils, like over a century ago, we thought these were all deciduous trees, so trees that lose their leaves like every 6 to 8 months, like in our temperate forests, and that they're roughly the same species spread over the entire continent. So kind of more of like a boring ecosystem, really. Just the same kind of plant spread over thousands of miles. But now what we know is that there's a surprising amount of diversity in these ecosystems. Still low diversity, just a handful of different plant types, but a remarkable functional change for how they existed relative to lake margins, river margins. We're discovering more about how these plants actually lived, and that's the focal point of our research.
Any sign of other life there, of animal life?
Absolutely, yeah. We have some of the first reptile fossils in Antarctica, in the areas that we work. And then if you go up to an area called the Antarctic Peninsula, which kind of extends towards Tierra del Fuego in South America, then you have some of our dinosaur fossils preserved there. So In the Mesozoic time interval. We have a surprising amount of vertebrate life and some insect life as well. So these ecosystems not only were comprised of plants, but also of early reptiles, some insects, and we also have microorganisms too. We can actually see fossil fungi in some of these ecosystems. So we're beginning to paint a much more robust picture, not only from the macroscopic scale, but also now the microscopic scale of how these ecosystems looked.
Well, you have a fascinating story of your own travels to that part of the world. Before we just began taping today's program, you said you've been there, this will be the fifth trip that you're going?
This will be the fifth trip, yep.
And we should say, as we're taping this program, you are about to get on a plane to head back to Antarctica.
That's right. I'll be leaving on November 23rd on Thanksgiving, just like last year, yeah.
And how long will you be down there?
Oh, probably about 2 months. I'll probably come back right before the semester begins, so probably in mid to late January.
Well, so tell us, what is life like in Antarctica?
Well, life today, Antarctica pretty much excludes most non-microbial life, aside from organisms that can live near the coast or near where the ice margin is. Antarctica is incredibly hostile to anything that's not even microbial. Like, even some microbial life has a hard time eking out an existence. And so being there...
What are the temperatures? Let's get a feel for...
Well, let's see. Their summer temperatures can be about as warm as our cold days here during our wintertime. That's their summer, though. They have 24 hours of light. But when it's not that warm, about minus 15 degrees Celsius, it can be as cold as minus 80 degrees Celsius with a wind chill, and that's in their summertime. In the wintertime, temperatures can plummet down towards minus 90 degrees Celsius for the air temperature, with wind speeds that are high enough to pick up cobbles of rocks and fling them through the air. Part of my campsites have been in these large dune fields, and these dunes, like you might think of sand dunes on a beach, these are dunes made up of cobbles and pebbles that are moved by the wind. So Antarctica can be incredibly hostile, especially in its winter time conditions.
So you're going in the summertime.
Yes.
Which is somewhat of a relief.
Somewhat
I guess.
Of a relief, yeah.
Still temperatures in what, the tens or the teens? Or?
Yeah, at its warmest too. And once you acclimate, those like minus 10, minus 15 degree temperatures feel like balmy summer days. But often what we'll be working in are probably about minus 40 degrees Celsius temperatures. That's about an average working condition. Some of the coldest conditions, we can only work outside for about 2 hours safely to avoid getting frostbite. And a lot of our work also involves rudimentary mountaineering. So it kind of blends our geologic fieldwork skills with some mountaineering, technical rock climbing, glacier travel, things like that. And that becomes incredibly challenging when the temperatures plummet.
Wow. So what do you sleep in, or where do you sleep?
Well, there's a lot of options, and there are different opinions about what people like to sleep in. I prefer to sleep in a simple mountaineering tent, which is a nylon tent that you might camp in anywhere in the world. It's yellow-colored, and the reason why I like a yellow-colored tent is that it's light enough to let sunlight come through, and that creates a greenhouse effect inside the tent. So it's much warmer, maybe 60 degrees Fahrenheit. When outside, it can be like minus 20, minus 30 degrees Celsius. And those tents will actually kind of melt their way into the glacier over their 2 months of camping in Antarctica. And then, you know, just a normal down sleeping bag. For really cold temperatures, I'll sleep in two sleeping bags.
Good Lord. This is not a vacation.
It's not a vacation, yeah. Yeah, sometimes the wind is whipping and it... your entire like rainfly of your tent is just reverberating against the wind. And so we have to communicate with our base camp, McMurdo Station, usually by sat phone. And so when we do our morning check-in on a satellite phone, they're surprised to hear the wind just like flapping our tents around.
So, Eric, how many scientists will accompany you on this field trip into literally no man's land?
Yeah. This year is going to be an exciting year. In my team, there are going to be seven people, including another professor from UWM, John Isbell. And so it'll be seven of us, including our mountaineer. But the exciting part is that it's not only our group, it's going to be another group of some friends and colleagues who are working on some reptiles, reptile fossils in the area, and then a whole bunch of biologists as well who are looking at microbial life in these little lakes and streams that actually exist on top of the glaciers. So we have a nice contingent of like a wide diversity of different science that's going on this year in our deep field camp.
And you physically have to get there, have to be there in order to recover the fossils.
Exactly. Yeah, we can't do this remotely at all, nor with robots or by satellite images. We have to physically go to the field. So like last year, we discovered a new fossil forest, which we think is the oldest fossil forest. The only way to do that is actually by having, you know, walking around the outcrop and looking for these fossils. It's true exploratory science. Most of the science, or most of the areas in Antarctica, haven't seen a human footprint ever. Or if they have, they may be five people in the history of Antarctic exploration who have ever been there. And so you're talking about five sets of eyes, looking at things, five sets of experiences looking at things. It's an area that's rife for new discoveries each time we go there. And so that is an imperative for why it requires human like involvement on the continent. There's an immense fossil resource there that we can learn from about not only our planet's history, but Antarctic's history as well. And we can only really do that by physically exploring the world there.
But there's so much snow, so much ice. I mean, you know, the miles of it, you know, it goes deep, deep, deep beneath your feet. Are you like literally just scraping the surface of what there is to see?
Oh, that's a fantastic point. Yeah, 99% of Antarctica is covered in ice and snow. That's a nice kind of take-home fact for sure. There is a small mountain range that extends all along the entire continent of Antarctica called the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. And that's actually where we work. So we work on these little rocky outcrops called nunataks, which are literally the very tops of mountains, where the most of the mountain, like 80, 90% of the mountain, is actually buried under glacial ice. So we basically just kind of go to the very tippy top of a mountain, and we work on that. And so far, that's what we're able to do. We've been working from about 74 degrees south latitude to 87 degrees south latitude, which is where I'm going this week. We've covered an immense amount of latitudinal coverage of these little mountain ranges. And that's how we're kind of gleaning these different insights. Some of our colleagues do take the approach of trying to look underneath the ice. And there's different approaches. One is a successful history of drilling. So we drill cores through the ice and we can get a climate history from that ice. But once we go past the ice, we can kind of look at the bedrock geology underneath. So some people like looking at the geology there to try to get a glimpse of what is underneath all this ice. So different kind of approaches. We kind of focus on the mountaintops, and some of my colleagues kind of peer underneath the ice with these like drilling probes.
And so you're looking for signs of life that may have been there, what, 250 million years ago, 260 million years ago. At the time those forests that we began talking about earlier were there, that snow and that ice was not there, right?
That's right. To the best of our knowledge, the glacial record that you see today in Antarctica was certainly not there 250 million years ago. Our colleague John Isbell did discover glacial evidence maybe 300 million years ago. So there were glaciers much older than the fossils that we found. And then these fossils came back as part of an ecosystem that existed where those glaciers once were. But at the time that they lived, we don't think there was glacial ice there. And some of our more recent fossils in Antarctica are of the Miocene age, around 14 million years old. These are actually freeze-dried fossils. So they're not rock. They're just mummified plant, moss, fungi. And they existed in a really neat little warm snap that occurred during Antarctica's current glacial conditions. Antarctica warmed up a little bit, and part of Western Antarctica thawed, and these forests came in and grew there for a period of time. And then the ice grew again and climate became much colder. And so that we have a neat kind of fossil record that spans these different kind of non-glacial to interglacial kind of periods.
What might those trees have looked like back a quarter of a billion years ago, and how would they differ from the trees in our backyard?
They would be kind of almost similar to your trees in your backyard, which should be surprising because most of the trees that grow at our very northernmost latitudes today are mostly needle-leaved conifers. But these trees that existed 250 million years ago would be about as tall as an oak tree.
They had leaves?
They had leaves, and these leaves were very big, and which is the surprising aspect of them. They're almost tropical leaf shapes. They're very large. They have a large area and large veins on them. And so it's a very curious leaf habit that we don't see today. These are extinct plants, and so they are able to survive and successfully reproduce in this climate with this really unique plant morphology that we don't see today at the high latitudes.
Wow. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio today is Eric Gulbranson. Eric is an assistant professor of geosciences at UW-Milwaukee and is, as you're listening to this program, somewhere in Antarctica, we believe, leaving Christmas or Thanksgiving Day here in 2017 and ready for a two-month journey down to the bottom of the world. Eric, you mentioned that this is your fifth trip down there. Do you ever get a sense sense of this is enough, it's cold, it's terrible conditions. What makes you keep coming back for more?
The science itself, that's the exciting thing. New discoveries that we're able to make because this area is so unexplored, because it's so inhospitable and so difficult to get there. They have the potential to make brand new discoveries for science, for uncovering the history of our planet. And like you said in your opening remark about learning more about what our planet was like before humans were on the scene. How did our Earth function as a system? What's the role of different kinds of organisms like plants or reptiles and things in shaping how our world is? And that's the exciting thing about working there. We have this really beautiful record of all these fossil organisms and this evolutionary change and these climatic changes in Antarctica. And we are poised to make these new discoveries because no one else has really gone there before, because it's so remote and so inhospitable.
Do you train to go down there? You have to be in good shape to have your body weather those extremes.
I think there are definitely opinions on that. I think some of my colleagues don't train, but you know, they're excellent scientists and excellent field scientists. But I personally try to train because I do know that the conditions are quite challenging. And a lot of the techniques that we use kind of merge mountaineering with geology. And so I do a lot of recreational mountaineering and rock climbing in addition to like physical training to prepare myself for those types of endeavors. Because one of the things is that it's so cold and so windy at times that it's, in my mind, it's important to have that kind of that muscle memory in place for when, if you encounter a crevasse, which is a large opening in a glacier, if someone were to fall into that crevasse, we need to know how to get them out. And that's actually part of our day-to-day work. Just to get the fossils, sometimes we encounter physical hazards that we have to negotiate and deal with. And so that training comes into play in those situations.
What do you eat when you're down there?
Lots of fat, lots of calories. Probably three times as many calories as you eat today here. And a lot of that being fat, different kinds of fats, because we burn so many calories just keeping warm. Even with all of our layers on, and even without, say, a lot of hiking or walking around, we're burning an immense amount of calories just to stay warm.
You also are exposed to sun.
Yeah.
Do you have to take special precautions not to get sunburned down there?
Absolutely, yeah. We apply sunblock liberally. Usually it's only our face that's exposed to the sun, but even then, we apply sunblock quite a lot, because there's also an ozone hole over Antarctica too. So we have enhanced UVB radiation over Antarctica in addition to there being 24 hours of sunlight. So we're actually really sensitive to irradiation from the sun.
What happens if something goes wrong? Is there help nearby?
There is. Antarctica has a really robust logistics package, including a search and rescue team, many types of aircraft, helicopters, fixed-wing aircraft, the U.S. Air National Guard. But even then, you know, there are situations in which aircraft can't always come and get you, or you may be so far away that people can't come to get you over land. And so you have to build into your research plan an ability to stay alive and survive in a situation in which you were stranded. And so we pack excess amounts of food. We pack extra tents. We try to build into our camping regimen kind of a backup plan if things were to really go badly.
You mentioned that you'll be down there with other scientists, some studying the climate, others
yes.
studying the plant life,
yes.
And others animal life. Do they come from all around the world? Is there a lot of international cooperation?
That's a great question. There is. That's one of the exciting things about being a scientist in Antarctica, is that geopolitical boundaries dissolve. We are part of the U.S. Antarctic program, so most of our colleagues are U.S. scientists, and they do a diverse array of different science. So you learn about physics, you learn about astronomy, you learn about glaciology, all these wonderful things that are going on while you're doing your own work. In addition to that, though, there are many other countries that are part of the Antarctic Treaty that conduct science. Antarctica is a scientific preserve, and so we routinely work with Italian colleagues from France, Germany, Argentina, and we work together in a nice collaborative environment. And our different cultural and political backgrounds seem to kind of, like, for lack of a better word, melt away because of just the fact that we're all excited and focusing on this science. And so we've been working internationally in terms of our collaboration since the beginning. Since the beginning of our group's efforts down there.
Where do you see your work going? Do you envision 10 or 20 years from now still doing research in that part of the world?
Oh, absolutely. But also branching out. So, branching out in Antarctica along these mountains. There's still many more rocky areas to explore and uncover new evidence for how life responded to different kinds of climate or ecologic changes. But also linking it up, too, with different areas of the world, different important scientific questions that can only be addressed by looking at, say, fossil plants in Argentina or the Russian Far East or the Canadian Arctic Archipelago. And so my approach to it, to science, is to try to find a compelling research question and then identify the areas that best address that question. And in the past, that's taken me to Argentina, to the Russian Far East, Ukraine, France, the American Southwest. And in the future, I see myself probably working in the Canadian Arctic Archipelago.
So what do your students think about these travels?
It's a very enticing prospect to join in on the research with these travels. I'm taking two undergraduate students, for example, to Argentina this spring for spring break as part of another NSF-funded grant that we have. And they'll receive training in geologic fieldwork and conduct these small geologic studies in Argentina with me. So they're really excited about this kind of international aspect to science.
Yeah, that's the great thing about being at a research university like UW-Milwaukee, isn't it? Where you have the capacity and the opportunity to literally travel the world to discover something new about the world.
Absolutely, yeah. And we have a nice array of faculty, too, in our Department of Geosciences that work internationally and have different expertise. And so we are able to train our students in a really nice, robust manner. So,
you know, I asked you what it might be like 10 or 20 years from now. We hear constantly about global warming, about the changes in our climate. Do you think that the warming of the Earth that is occurring now is going to have a significant impact on the landmass, on the ice that you see in Antarctica?
Absolutely. That's one of the sort of ideas of significance for the research that we do, is to try to see how this would impact, say, future warming. So what we have, what's important about the fossil record is that it gives us a glimpse into like kind of the beginning, middle, and end of climate changes. We're in a climate change scenario now, but what we don't know is where it's going to go. And so the fossil record gives us kind of a glimpse of how these things have transpired in the Earth's past. And so by studying those fossil record in more detail, we might be able to get a better glimpse for what kind of future changes to, say, life, ecosystems, and how those also change Earth's climate, how all those things will work together.
And will the ice itself be melting so you'll be able to see deeper down below?
Oh, absolutely.
Other fossils?
Yeah, absolutely. We already get a glimpse of that too, the breaking of different ice shelves. They release certain like rocky areas of the continent that we weren't able to see before. And so the removal of the ice, while it does change our contemporary climate system today, it does affect the ability to do field work there in Antarctica in a positive way, and by virtue of just giving us more exposure of rocks.
Yeah, there's really kind of – it's ironic that that what may not be so good for the world overall is making your research a little bit easier.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. Well, and so I want to go back to the notion of how far down you might be able to go through the ice down into the rock bed to see different life. Because as you've described it to me, I'm imagining the analogy would be doing research on top of the Rocky Mountains. And if you had to figure out what life in North America is like just by looking at the top of those mountains, that's sort of what you're trying to do now.
Exactly.
Or have to do because you can't get farther down to see, you know, the hundreds or thousands of feet of exposed rock and fossils below.
Yeah, exactly. No, you hit the nail on the head. That's the main challenge of doing geology and studying the evolution of life is that our record is inherently incomplete, mostly just due to exposure, not because of people not trying hard. It's hard to get access to or a complete record of these different fossil lineages or the rocks that host them. So one of the ways that we could do that, say in a place like Antarctica, is to drill through that. One of my colleagues, John Googe at the University of Minnesota Duluth, he has worked with colleagues at Madison to develop a rapid access ice drill. He's able to transport this drilling rig anywhere on the continent and drill, you know, like 300 meters through the ice to find like thinner veneers of ice, drill through the ice, and then core the bedrock and uncover what those mountains look like beneath the ice. So it's kind of a surprising and exciting new development for ice drilling down there.
Beats waiting around for another 1,000 or 2,000 years to see things melt. So what does your family think of you traveling around the world or to the bottom of the world in this case?
It's a challenge. You know, I have a satellite phone, and so I'm able to call as much as I want to stay connected. But I'm gone for 2 months. And like I kind of intimated with you, like some of the work there is kind of challenging and there's an element of risk to it. And so I save some of those stories until I get back about what exactly happens in terms of like glacier travel and things like that. But you know, they're excited though. My children, I think, are very excited about me going to Antarctica. They're very proud of that.
How old are they?
8 and 5.
Oh, so they're perfect. They're thinking of dinosaurs.
Exactly.
And what might be there.
Yeah, and I think they like the kind of the polar exploration aspect of things. And then my girlfriend too is very supportive of me going down there, but it's challenging being away for so long.
Yeah.
Especially over the holidays too. You know, we can only work there in their summer, which is unfortunately right over the peak of our holiday season, and so you miss out on so many different fun like family gatherings.
And it's not the place where you're going to take the family along, is it?
Exactly. No, it's a bit too too harsh and inhospitable for that.
Yeah. Just amazing work. So when you get back, just one last question: will the results be available? Will you be doing reports as part of your National Science Foundation studies, or how do we find out what you learned?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things that what we have to do and what we actually enjoy doing is writing up the results of our work, and we publish that and disseminate that knowledge as widely as we can. One of the first things we try to do is publish that in peer-reviewed journals, and that's like the gold standard for our scientific communication to the broader scientific community. And then from that, we try to distill down that information and disseminate it to the public at large, because, you know, scientists writing to other scientists, we speak a different kind of jargony language. And that can be unfortunate for communication, but we try to disseminate that knowledge even broader still by distilling it down into its essence. Like, what have we found? Why is that important?
Well, Eric, how about if we invite you back when you return from the Antarctic?
That'd be perfect.
And let's hear about this latest adventure down at the bottom of the world.
I would love to. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Gulbranson, Assistant Professor of Geosciences at UW-Milwaukee, describing the work that he is currently doing down in Antarctica. As you listen to this program, he will be, we presume, somewhere out on the field, not on
exactly.
The ice. We wish you luck. Travel safe, Eric, and come back and tell us some stories.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of UWM Today. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.